You're listening to Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis with a show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. It's just another day at the waste management recycling facility in Sun Valley. The trucks that drive through your neighborhood and pick up everything in those blue bins drop it all off at facilities like this one. Every single item here gets shuttled on conveyor belts, picked up by human hands or robot arms, sorted into chutes and streams, all with the goal of diverting it from the landfill. The manager of this recycling plant, Kevin Vaughn, says the process is nothing like most blue bin users think it is.
They think everything is just recyclable or everything just gets put in a bin in a hole buried at a landfill. Totally different. It blows your mind when you're actually involved and see it.
Here on Greater LA, we asked for your climate questions, and boy, did you get back to us with inquiries about the recycling system. Among them, is the stuff you're throwing into the blue bin actually getting recycled? Is all the sorting and cleaning and separating even worth it? Well, here's KCRW's Kaylee Wells with some answers.
To make the blue bin worth it requires a lot of energy and commitment from the mostly guys in hard hats and reflector vests wandering around this recycling plant, making all the cogs in this very complicated machine run smoothly.
Yeah, so this is where everything begins.
At this facility in Southern California, the pile of recyclables that 5 million of us make in just one day is so big that it makes the semi-truck unloading its haul right now look like a toy. Mark Grady is the Southern California Recycling Director.
You can kind of see the recycle pile, a lot of cardboard.
It's mostly cardboard, and he says a decade ago it was mostly newspaper, but times change.
Some people call it the Amazon effect, but you see a lot of cardboard.
The stuff in this pile is about to embark on a long, winding journey of sorting, separating, picking, grabbing, shooting, and shuttling around a maze of conveyor belts. Up goes the material to a series of giant, spiraling corkscrews.
What that does is big material stays on the top, little material falls through.
Anything smaller than about a foot falls through the spirals and heads for the pre-sort room. Here's Kevin Vaughn again.
And then right now, this is where the sorters are trying to capture as much contamination out of the stream as possible.
Half a dozen men in masks are watching the mostly cardboard fly by them. Occasionally, the guy in front shouts,
Metal.
And a teammate behind him fishes out an old cooking pan to send it down a chute toward the metal stream. But most of the time, they're quietly grabbing bubble wrap or a plastic takeout bag. They're pulling it off the line and dropping it into one of the trash chutes lining the sides of the belt. Once a piece of material makes it past the first batch of humans, it moves on to my favorite part. Here's where the paper, plastic, cardboard, and aluminum get sent off to their own separate streams.
We have six MSS units.
It's a little too loud in here to talk to the hard hat guys, but I can see at the end of this conveyor belt a really strong fan. Paper and cardboard hits the fan and floats up. Plastic and metals fall down. A giant magnet picks up the metal stuff on the lower belt, and everything else heads towards its own set of robots. Here's Mark Grady again.
So these ones are here, so you can see the clear plastic mostly going by, right?
That loud burst of air that keeps interrupting him is one of the robot arms. It reminds me of those carnival claws searching for stuffed animals, except it's fast, and it's actually good at grabbing stuff.
If there's a cup, say, like a styrofoam cup or something that doesn't meet that spec, it's gonna pick it up and get it out of the stream.
The robot arms on the paper conveyor belt are even busier, sucking up as many as 1,000 pieces per minute. But even if the fans and the humans and the robots don't sort everything right, the misfits get a second chance. A plastic bottle in the paper stream, say, doesn't get sent to landfill. The robot sends it to another conveyor belt back to the beginning of this whole process to give it a second chance at getting sorted correctly.
It may say, hey, it's not right for this bunker where we're going to make this material, but it goes into a conveyor under us that goes back and goes through another opportunity to get picked.
The system manages to recycle the vast majority of what comes through here. And the biggest problem isn't mistakes at the facility, it's the mistakes that you and I make when we put stuff in the blue bin. Bowling balls, garden hoses. When I was there, I saw a whole chair, a giant tarp, one of those toy cars that children can get in. Y'all, come on. And then there are the recyclables that get tossed in all wrong. Hammer says if there's one thing he wants listeners to walk away with, stop putting your recyclables in trash bags.
Bagging materials is the single biggest thing that we want to prevent people from doing.
The machinery here is designed to sort loose stuff.
And when you bag it, now you don't know what's in there.
Bagged recyclables go straight to landfill. Some of it isn't our fault, though. There's recyclable stuff that the machinery can't actually process.
Some of it is just the inability to capture perfectly the different components that are in there because they're too small. A piece of paper that's 2 inches.
Or plastics with the number 6 or 7 on them. Technically recyclable, but not in this facility. Or perhaps the greatest offender of all, plastic bags, even recyclable ones.
They're problematic because of the technological aspects of it where they wrap and they blow and they get all over.
Jamming the machines and slowing everything down, reducing how many recyclables they can get through in a given day. So if most of this really is getting recycled, where does it actually end up? Aluminum cans are great because they get turned into new cans, and that happens over and over again. Plastic bottles, on the other hand, might get turned into toys or clothes or carpet, but probably won't get recycled again after that. As for the rest of it...
The biggest components certainly are the cardboard and the paper.
Those frequently hitch a ride on the boat back to China to bring us new cardboard boxes filled with the stuff we're buying online. So our recycling system is far from perfect, but it is working.
The more recycling that you can do on glass, aluminum, plastic, and paper, that you're not cutting down trees or you're not, you know, using more oil out of the ground to do it. I mean, just our plants here in Southern California are sending thousands and thousands of tons every month to be recycled, and it's from cities all over Southern California, and it does make a difference.
So to the many listeners who asked if it's really worth the effort to recycle, yeah, it really is. For KCRW, I'm Kaylee Wells.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Kind of like losing a friend after getting word that Paul Rubens died. The man boy known as Pee Wee Herman brought joy to a lot of folks, as few have done. That work came in the form of his renowned Pee Wee's Playhouse and its many iterations. With us to remember Paul Rubens, a.k.a. Pee Wee Herman, or his longtime friend and groundling collaborator, Lorraine Newman. Lorraine, welcome to you.
Thank you so much, Steve. Hi.
E.G. Daly, who played Dottie in Pee Wee's Big Adventure, is also with us. E.G., thank you. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
Lorraine, Pee Wee's Playhouse started as part of a stage show, right? Right here in L.A. at the Roxy Theater.
Well, it started at the Groundlings first. Yeah, we had something called In Ones, which was when you did a character down left. And it started out as just like a single character. He used to throw Tootsie Rolls to the audience. And but it was just a single character that he did. And then by the time it got to the Roxy, it had developed with a full cast and these incredible sets by an artist named Gary Panter.
Paul came to L.A. in the 1970s, went to CalArts, so sort of developed his craft, right, through schooling there.
Yeah,
and
that's
got into
where
the
I met
scene.
Him. I met him in 1973 at CalArts, and we did an improv show there, and we were kind of like kindred spirits immediately. His hair, if you can imagine, was like down his back. You know, he had really long hair. And then I left after 3 months to join this workshop that we developed into the Groundlings. And then he was kind of done at CalArts. And I said, you really should go to this group. I think it's for you.
He was the creative genius sort of at the heart of it all, developing Pee-wee into a full-on character, obviously. His alter ego, if you will. Talk about Lorraine, his vision, and how he went about executing it.
Well, you know, I don't know that I was specifically privy to that, but I do know as the show expanded, John Paragon and Phil Hartman contributed to the writing of that full vision of the show.
Phil Hartman, as in Saturday Night Live alum. You're a Saturday Night Live alum before Phil Hartman's days, though. But, I mean, it's sort of all is one big world, right?
Isn't it, though?
Yeah. There's a fairly famous story about Phil Hartman getting mad because he thought Paul was such a good performer, and he wanted him to do more than just Pee-wee.
Oh, I didn't know that, but I saw him do a lot of other things at the Groundlings that were just great, including a character named Jay Longtoe, who he couldn't do now because it was a Native American with full feather headdress, and he would he had these Converse high tops. And he did that toe dancing with that. That's how he started it.
E.G., you joined the team after the stage show. You joined for the movie, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, famously playing Dottie. Let's hear that clip.
Look, Dottie, I like you.
I like you.
That's the thing. I like you, too.
Dottie!
There's a lot of things about me you don't know anything about, Dottie. Things you wouldn't understand. Things you couldn't understand.
Things you shouldn't understand.
I don't understand.
You don't want to get mixed up with a guy like me. I'm a loner, Dottie. A rebel.
So that's when you came into sort of the Pee-wee realm. Talk a little bit about how it affected your career.
Something about that film was really unexpected. I didn't know how huge it was going to be, and it wasn't till, you know, it kind of got completed that we were like, oh my gosh, this is really good. I got to be in this amazing pop culture iconic project that will be forever. And the fact that it's all about childlike behavior, you know, it's like, who doesn't want to like let their little inner child out constantly? You know, to me, that is speaks bigger than anything, is the fact that Paul really, really embraced that kind of childlike thing, the kid, the innocence, the funniness of the kid. And I just feel really grateful to be a part of that, because I feel super connected to the childlike part of me, and to get to be in the movie was really pretty incredible.
I mean, you've sort of taken that on, haven't you, in the years since? I mean, you have voiced so many things.
Yeah, that's what's so crazy. I'm known for being a baby and a child and a kid. And yeah, I just feel like it sort of set the tone for a lot of things for me.
Was that what precipitated it? So, I mean, you took that role and it was like, oh, well, maybe there's something else there for me.
You can't really know that kind of stuff. That's what's so beautiful about just being open and moving on to the next thing and the next thing, and not waiting around to see how it does or if it blows up or doesn't blow up. I would just do a movie, move on, and then beautifully turned around and was like, oh my gosh, I was Dottie and I'm Dottie forever in this beautiful film that has been so revered and celebrated year after year. And also just getting to be friends with Paul all those years, and the kind of person that he is, just this kind, thoughtful human being. And I just feel grateful to have had him as a person in my life all those years, you know, to know him and to see how he operated with people he knows. And I mean, Lorraine, you probably got all the birthday wishes every birthday from him, right?
Oh, God, yes. All day long. I also got, like, the personalized one where he's saying, you know, yes, it's me, Paul Rubens, I took time off my busy day. I'll be right there, you know. he did that one for me, too. And, of course, the yearly Christmas card. I have all of them. But more importantly, you know, I think the significant thing was he was very close to my sister, Tracy. She was his teacher and director at the Groundlings. And we would have these three-way texts going, you know, about some topic that he initiates, and then it would just go on, and I'll miss those terribly.
The word that has come up over and over again when it comes to Paul Rubens, Pee-wee Herman, is joy. Is that how you would describe him?
It's really interesting. I've watched Paul for a long time, and I've seen him do interviews, and knowing him and knowing his character, it's almost like he felt, it's almost watching like he was more comfortable in that childlike persona. And in person, he seemed a little more shy. He was a little quieter and a little more subdued, I think, you know, just gentle and calm. But there was something about where he lit up when he was in that character. I think that's what makes it such a joyful thing, is that growing up and dealing with life is like a whole other thing. It's like, but holding on to like the silliness of a kid and the thinking of a kid and the perspective of a kid, it just makes things lighter and simple, and it's all funny. So how could he not bring a lot of joy to people and a lot of fun? Because that was sort of his whole, that's like he embraced that character so much for everybody. And I think that's why it's sustaining it with such power, because, you know, we need that.
Lorraine?
Well, yes, he was very quiet, you know, when he was not performing. But I think what was so relatable with the character of Pee-wee was it was a very specific and personal vision of his observations as a young person and a child. He brought his innocence, his personal experience, and then ultimately it was combined with John Paragon's personal experience of childhood. And, you know, John and Paul's, especially their voices together in the content of the material, was so idiosyncratic and relatable and very innocent and very sweet. But to be honest, there were some aspects of it that were just for them, you know. So.
E.G. Daily, also known as Dottie,
yeah.
Lorraine Newman, thank you both for talking with us today and remembering Paul Rubens, Pee-wee Herman, who we lost yesterday. We appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
Hey, Steve.
Well, building the world of Pee-wee's Playhouse was a group effort, to be sure, with famous faces like Lawrence Fishburne, Grace Jones in front of the camera. But behind the camera was a team of devoted artists bringing the visuals of that wacky world to life. And with us now to talk about the artier side of Pee-wee is artist Wayne White. Wayne, welcome to you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Co-set designer, puppet designer, puppeteer, you were brought into the world of Pee-wee after the stage show, after the movie. Talk about coming in to build the Playhouse and what that was like.
Yeah, Pee-wee was really hot at that time. It was 1986. He was very popular off the Pee-wee's Big Adventure movie. And I had just, I was a struggling artist in New York City. I was trying to be a cartoonist and an illustrator, and I'd been struggling for 4 years. But oddly enough, I did this puppet show on the side. I called it a punk rock kind of puppet show experience. I just do them at parties and stuff. And weirdly, I got a professional job down in Nashville, which I'm from Tennessee originally, and I knew people in Nashville. And I got a job doing a kid show down there called Mrs. Kabobble's Caboose. I did all the sets and puppets for it. That was fall of 85. Then I went back up to New York, where I was living, of course, and I had my Mrs. Kabobble's Caboose portfolio, and I heard that Pee-wee Herman was going to do a kid show on CBS, and I found out it was at a place called Broadcast Arts on Lower Broadway in New York, and I took my new portfolio over there. I showed a producer, a woman named Prudence Fenton, my Mrs. Kabobble's Caboose, And it was a perfect fit for Pee-wee, and she hired me there that day, and I started right away. It was thrilling to work there. So I, and then I was joined by Gary Panter and Rick Heitzman as fellow set designers. And I also did the puppets too. And it was quite an adventure. It was one of a kind experience. But we all brought to it this kind of fresh insight because none of us were TV professionals. We were all painters and cartoonists and sculptors, downtown New York artists. So that's what gave the Playhouse the edge and the freshness and the energy it did. We weren't playing by any rote television rules or professionalism. We were just kind of having fun and making it up and not worrying about anything really except just doing our thing. And Paul was the perfect boss because he let us do our thing.
Well, I mean, so I was going to ask you, what kind of direction did Paul Rubens give you in doing? Because you may have said there were no rules, right? But if you're on CBS, yeah, there are some rules.
Well, oddly enough, this was a very, very unique situation. There was a woman named Judy Price at the time who was the head of children's programming at CBS. And she really loved Paul, and she really believed in him. So there was rules, but she gave us so much freedom through Paul so that, you know, there were really not the normal television rules at all. I know that sounds kind of flighty and unbelievable, but it really wasn't. It was a really open-ended creative situation that I never came across before or after, and I was in 30 years in television. So that's really the power of the Playhouse, the fact that it was just let the artist take over the asylum, you know?
You mentioned that you were doing this in Manhattan, right? But
yeah,
meanwhile, meanwhile, years before, right here in L.A. on the Sunset Strip, Pee-wee's Playhouse was, you know, it didn't start out as that, right?
No, it started out as a stage show.
It was a stage play.
Yeah, at the Roxy.
Yeah, at the Roxy Theater. I want to play this. I want to play this all the way dating back to the early 1980s. This is Pee-wee and Missy Vaughn from the Roxy Theater on the Sunset Strip. Let's listen.
Pee-wee, can you keep a secret?
Can I? I love secrets.
I have a secret wish.
Well, what is it?
That Captain Carl would like me.
But he does like you.
No. I mean really like me. Yes.
That was Missy Vaughn, a character played by a woman named Lynn Marie Stewart. Early 1980s, L.A., Sunset Strip. Not only did you have, like, you know, I don't know, Neil Young and the Eagles playing, you know, but then you had Pee-wee's Playhouse, too, and it wasn't a children's show. It was an adult show.
It never really was a kid's show. Even when we were working on it on CBS, we never thought of it as a kid's show. I mean, it was a parody of a kid's show or, a pastiche of a kid's show, whatever you want to use. But we never thought we were doing it for kids. We were doing it for ourselves, really, you know.
You've had a very long career in the arts, obviously, with painting, still making puppets, right? It all, I mean, this is like one big playland for you, isn't it?
Yeah, and it all because of the Playhouse. It opened every door for me. It allowed me a 30-year career in television, doing kid shows and videos and commercials. And now I'm out of showbiz, and I'm in the art world now, making paintings and sculptures. But I still make giant puppets and stuff, and I get to call it art now.
You get to call it art. That's right. But it is art. That's what it is. You're not, it's no lie.
Yeah. But when you're working in kids' TV, people tend to look down on you. But when you mention Pee-wee's Playhouse, all bets are off because that thing transcended, man. It really was a work of art and so many talented people on it, you know. It really changed my life miraculously.
Wayne White, artist, set designer, puppet designer, puppeteer on Pee-wee's Playhouse. Our condolences to you, Wayne, and thank you for coming on and sharing your memories. We appreciate it.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this evening for Greater LA. Tomorrow on the program, it's part two of the recycling bin conundrum. What can go in there? All kinds of questions answered for you tomorrow right here on GLA. have a question for us, maybe doesn't include blue bins or something else, maybe a story idea, or you just want to grab the podcast, you can do that at our website, kcrw.com/GLA, or do it on the app as well through your iPhone or Android. You can tell us how you're doing, and of course, grab the podcast too so you can take us with you on the go. kcrw.com/GLA. We'd love to see you there, and we'd love to have you in our lineup. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthews, Celine Mendiola, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Katie Gilchrist, Sonia Geis, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordahl all helped assemble this evening's episode. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your time. Thanks for your ear. Have a great night.